Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Last year, we saw one of the ugliest, nastiest elections in our nation's history. Accusations of lying and verified accounts of untruths flowed nonstop over the past year. And everyone stretches the truth, right? Whether it's offering a disingenuous compliment or fibbing as to why you were late. The politicians? Well, according to surveys and polls, people have a difficult time believing their elected officials are telling the truth. Do they really stand for what they say? And this isn't just a national issue. It happens here in Washington state, too. Levi Polkinen is a reporter at the Seattle PI. He covers courts and crime, and he compiled a list of Seattle politicians' most egregious abuses of power. Hey, Levi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Digging back into our history, what did you find?
It's astounding how many streets and public places in our city are named after men who have done like obvious theft from the public or from business associates. Henry Yesler is just the best example of this. He arrived in Seattle and was kind of an economic force in the city. He founded a mill on the south end of Lake Union. And then he decided he would run the state's first lottery. And Henry Yesler put his mill up. So he sells about $30,000 worth of these tickets for this mill. And then he pockets the money and walks away and keeps his mill and just soaks all the people that had bought these lotto tickets from.
That's terrible.
It's terrible.
And he's not the only person.
No, not at all. So Corliss Stone was a mayor of Seattle back in the 1870s. At some point, he took up with a married woman and ran off to San Francisco, I believe taking $15,000 in city money. He also wasn't the only person in the city to pull something like this. Adolph Krug was the city treasurer, and he skipped town with about $125,000, and he headed east and was apprehended in Minneapolis. It was this kind of pattern of scandal where you had these powerful people just taking money. There wasn't any kind of subtlety to it. There wasn't like they were going, you know, bags of money from lobbyists or campaign donations.
There was no laundering involved.
No.
Just direct
it's like,
access.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is just going to be theft today. So,
and then we'll have a street named after
us. Yeah. And then you can go to Stone Way and do your hardware shopping and all of that. So,
how does what happened in the past compare to what you see happening today with our elected officials and our leaders?
Oh, it's much more subtle now at the very least. And I guess the financial incentives for just obvious graft aren't there anymore. That's not to say that it doesn't exist. It is. I think it's much more subtle. You look at like the crimes that state auditor Troy Kelly was accused of or is accused of are really complicated. They're not grabbing a bag of money, getting on a train with your friend's wife and heading to San Francisco.
Yeah. Do you ever wonder how these figures from the past, how they would hold up under the scrutiny of the modern 24-hour news operation?
Well, that's an interesting question because, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't think people were worse then. If they were alive today, I mean, Corliss Stone would probably, you know, be a member of Congress who then goes and works on K Street and he'd get his money that way. I like to be optimistic and think we're getting better, but there's also more money in politics now than ever. So I don't know. I mean,
yeah. And people will always lie.
Yeah. People will always lie.
Levi Polkinen, writer for the Seattle PI, courts and crime reporter. Thank you for joining us today here on Sound Effect.
Thank you so much.
Today on Sound Effect, our theme is Liar, Liar. We're telling the stories of liars and cheats, from students who get scammed by one of their own to the desperate things we'll say to prevent a bad situation from getting worse. We'll also hear from people who are hunting down the truth. It's all just ahead on Sound Effect. We're going to stay in the history department for a little longer. This next story is about one of the most notorious slippery liars in the Northwest back in the early 1900s. She managed to bilk thousands of dollars out of railroad companies. Her name? Maud Wagnon. The alias she worked under was Maud Johnson. Maud's story of deception was almost forgotten until one day Logan Camporeale found an old booklet. He's a student at Eastern Washington University, and he was working at the Washington State Archives. This is where he came across a catalog of wanted prisoners. Yes, a catalog from the year 1913.
So I was just sitting at home showing this document to a friend and, you know, assuming these are all men. And he had the wits to ask, well, are there any females in this little catalog here? And we found a name that looked sort of female, Maud Johnson. And sure enough, there she was. The only female in the catalog.
Who was this woman, this outlier? Logan wanted to know, so he started to hunt for more information. Logan's research is paying off. With the help of KNKX staffers reading a few old historical documents, he tells Maud's story.
From the Daily East Oregonian, Friday, September 3rd, 1909. Queen of Fakers will be sentenced here. Maud Bainey convicted in 1905 of obtaining money under false pretenses.
This from the Spokane Daily Chronicle, August 5th, 1909, is Woman a Faker? San Francisco authorities arrest an alleged grafter accused of defrauding many railroad companies in New York, Portland, Seattle, Tacoma. A woman giving her name as Mrs. Maud Myrtle Johnson was arrested at the Merritt Hospital in Oakland yesterday and will be held pending action by the Seattle authorities.
So Maud Johnson is the queen of fakers. She's dubbed that by a number of different newspapers. And what she was doing was traveling from city to city, defrauding an infant industry, electric railroads, interurban railroads. And these were basically trolleys that you used to get around town. And Maud would show up in a town, get on one of these railroads. She'd ride it until there was sort of a jolt or a jump when there was a break in the tracks or something. And she would throw herself on the ground and fake injury. And according to the report, she could dislocate some of her limbs. And then also she would use some sort of fake blood in order to indicate that she was having internal hemorrhaging, which then she would use to try to secure a claim from a claim agent that worked for the train company. Maud Johnson, as far as I can tell, was born in Eastern Oregon in the late 1800s. I can't really track much of Maud's life up until she starts appearing in newspapers. She gets caught passing bad checks in Pendleton, Oregon. And she's in jail with three other folks, and they actually break out of jail. It just says, like, they saw it out. It's not very clear. You know, it's just newspaper articles. At least in her mugshot that was taken in, I believe, 1910. She has sort of a bobbed haircut, sort of curly around the edges, not very long, just barely past her ears. In an era before good fingerprinting, the only way to identify people was by unique markings that they had or unique features. On one place on Maud's conviction register, it has large pointy ears. A number of cases, and maybe even in some cases, the motivation for Maud to get this money illegally was to fund some sort of traveling theater that she was directing. It sounds like she sort of directed this and had a troupe of actors that would have gone with her throughout the Pacific Northwest. The Variety article that says that Maud scammed about $200,000 out of railroad companies, it claims that $150,000 of that money was spent to produce these shows, which leads me to believe that they must have been pretty substantial. The railway organizations were quickly paying out a lot of money to Maude. The more established railroad industry already had a really established system to catch fraudulent activity, but the newer railroads, these interurbans, didn't. And one of the claim agents, his name was B.F. Boynton, and he started an organization where he reached out to all of the other claim agents for different interurban railroads, and they started working together to try to catch Maude. So the Pacific Claim Agents Association was founded with the explicit intent of catching Maude Johnson. And then they even, you know, went as far as to release wanted posters.
Any person knowing of the whereabouts of this woman will please notify B.F. Boynton, President, Pacific Claim Agents Index Bureau for the Prevention of Accident Fraud, 520.
I can track down three specific incidences where she ended up in jail for a different crime. Once in 1905 in Pendleton, and then in 1909 she's caught in Oakland. She's convicted of obtaining money on false pretenses, and she's sentenced to a 1 to 5 year sentence. She immediately tries to do an appeal, and while she's on appeal, she sends this amazing letter to the warden of the Walla Walla State Penitentiary while she was in jail awaiting her appeal.
Dear sir, pardon me for taking the liberty to write you, but I wish to know some of the rules of your institution. First, am I allowed to bring my trunk with me? Second, are we allowed our own clothes, or are we furnished uniforms? Third, as I am in ill health having a fibroid tumor, I rush to know if I may bring the medicine that I am now taking, as I am under the care of Dr. Cass of Vancouver at present. Of course, I know that no opiate would be allowed, and there is none in my treatment.
And that's how Maude starts working this case to get out of prison. It's really about this illness. And her advocates outside of prison use that as the main reason they think she should be freed. She gets letters from all sorts of people.
My dear Governor, I understand that the minimum sentence of Miss Maude Johnson, now in the penitentiary at Walla Walla, will soon expire. I am informed that she is in very poor health and will not likely live long unless she is released from the penitentiary and given an outdoor life and proper treatment. Yours very truly, Oswald West, Governor of Oregon, May 29th, 1911.
My dear Governor, I just returned home and find on my desk your letter of the 29th. I'm sorry to say to you that Mrs. Johnson's record is of such nature, and there has been so many protests filed against her release, that I'm satisfied there is no prospects of her immediate release. With kindest personal regards, Governor Hay, Washington State.
Fortunately for Maude, though, 1912 comes, a new governor comes in, and that's when I think Maude secures her release. In an era before parole, essentially what she has to do is secure a first friend, which is someone that will allow her to live with them and also will employ her. And just about 2 weeks after she arrives there, there's a letter in the file to the warden of the state penitentiary saying Maude disappeared. So that's how Maude ends up on the run again.
To Henry Drum, superintendent of Walla Walla Penitentiary. We have Maude Johnson, the woman you offered $50 reward for. Come and get her. From Donald McRae, Sheriff, Snohomish County.
I don't know if she was actually doing a fraud or something, but she gets caught there and then goes back, and she ends up serving the rest of her sentence until, I believe, 1915, when she's finally released. I don't know what happens to Maude. It's something that eats me up pretty regularly. I've never been able to track down a death record. It really bothers me. No burial site. There's really not much else I know about Maude after she's released from prison. I mean, the story captivates me for the obvious reasons of it just being, you know, it's sex, drugs, and rock and roll in 1910, you know? She's really, you know, bending the mold of what's allowed and what's possible. You know, she's not scared to scapegoat males, and that's often what she says is the problem. She says, you know, It's the bad male influences in her life that are causing these problems. She's really aware of gender, and her ability to manipulate it is impressive, and it's fun to read about. It shows in part the wild, wild west nature of Washington in 1910. We live in a pretty modern world here, but just 100 years ago, we were living in the wild west. People couldn't even communicate effectively enough to catch criminals, you know? They were sending telegrams to each other. The difference in technology is amazing. And Maud was taking advantage of technology. Obviously, there's the mystery aspect, too. I have a hard time accepting the fact that Maud just, you know, adopted another alias and, you know, lived happily ever after on a farm in Oregon. I'm sure Maud did some other crazies in this life, so I'm inspired to continue looking, and I'm honestly hoping that talking over the radio here, there might be some chance that someone's heard of Maud Wagnon or knows something about the Wagnon family or wants to try to help me dig this up. Oh, man, I would be immensely grateful.
I want to talk, baby, by myself. No one to talk with, happy on the shelf. Ain't misbehaving, save my love.
That was Logan Camporeale, a student at Eastern Washington University. He's planning to write a book about Maud Wagnon. You also heard the voices of Ed Ronco, Ariel Van Cleve, Allie Ferguson, Kevin Kniestad, Will James, and Bob Norberg.
Kisses are worth my waiting for. Believe me, I don't stay out late, don't care to go. Home about 8 million radio. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX 88.5 FM. I'm Jennifer Wing, and today's theme is liar, liar. And there are many reasons why we lie. Sometimes people lie to steal money. This past spring, hundreds of thousands of dollars, possibly over $1 million, were stolen from Chinese international students going to school at the University of Washington. About 90 students fell for a scam that promised 5% off their tuition bill for summer classes if they used a third party, an alleged fellow student who went by the pseudonym FY to make the payment. 21-year-old Justin Su, a mechanical engineering student on a budget and looking to save money, took the bait. His heart sank when the university called to tell him that they did not receive the $11,000 needed to pay for his summer quarter.
First, I was really confused, so it might be a mistake from them. And once I immediately went to the international office and asked about it, and a lady in the office told me that it was a scam. And I was really I was really angry because I just got cheated on that. Yeah, they used my trust and stole the money.
Tiffany Rand joins us in the studio, and you are a writer for Northwest Asian Weekly, and you covered this story. And can you explain how this unfolded?
Everyone kind of attributes this back to this mysterious FY, this female student who has been a leader of the Helsky Help Organization over at the University of Washington. And a lot of students had gotten these WeChat messages from her, basically introducing a discount of sorts, 5% off their tuition. If they were to provide the login information for their student accounts to her or some other friend of hers, they will complete the transaction for them and make that payment at a discounted rate. WeChat is a social media app that's very commonly used in China. So this is a way for someone like FY to basically use a pseudonym and approach many, many people.
And another thing that Justin said, FY is a trusted person.
She was really popular, like she was famous among the Chinese students, so everybody thought she would not do such thing like this.
Yeah, so she was a student at the time at the University of Washington.
Graduated now, I believe, and no longer in the country is what we assume. Not only was she popular among the students because she led this organization, something that surprised me was that she really took the principles behind this organization of helping international students. She took this concept and brought it to China. So she's actually, in my research, I found that she's actually hosted a couple of events in various provinces in China, instructing students on how life in the States would be like, what they would have to prepare if they wanted to go to school there. And this was a very big thing for a lot of students in China hoping to go to the United States. Her seminar or her face was one of the first introductions to this idea.
She did this as a student.
She did.
She went to China and kind of laid the groundwork for people interested in coming to study here.
Right.
And then when they were here, the Husky Help organization has that word help in it.
Yes.
How did it help students?
I know first and foremost, it was a community. So it's a kind of a central place that you can go and seek out other students that are in similar circumstances as you. If you're coming into the States, not quite familiar with the language, not quite familiar with how things work. So I believe that it was primarily social, but probably also offered a lot of good resources behind that.
Do we know this person's name?
I did encounter a name, but I wasn't able to substantiate it. And at the time of my reporting, I was told by the UW law enforcement that was involved with the investigation that they are asking media to not release any names for the security of the investigation. At this point, they are not certain whether this FY student is just a member of a larger organization, using her connections to reach out to those that she knows. She could be one of many.
How did the mechanics of this scam work? How did the money get from for the summer quarter get from the students into these international bank accounts?
I was told by Justin and some other students that they were instructed to write a check or provide this money to a friend of hers who would come and pick up that payment from them, who would then somehow pass it on to FY. And from that point on, it gets a little hazy. Something that surprised me while I was reporting on this was that, you know, I came in thinking that this was happening at the University of Washington, but law enforcement at the University of Washington had said that they've spoken to other schools, and it's very likely that the scam has also been happening at other schools, not just within the state, but within the country.
In talking to Justin, one of the things that really surprised him and seemed very hurtful is that this came from within the Chinese community.
I think it shouldn't be like this at all. Like, the Chinese people should be helping each other in another country, not to cheat on other people.
I can only relate as an immigrant. Something that's ingrained for most immigrants, I would think, is that you come to this country and once you've made it, you give back. I believe that they come to this country and they're seeking out other international students who have been in their shoes, who are willing to help them. And that community building is very essential for them. It essentially replaces the family unit that they were so used to having. So for this to come from one of their own community members, it's very shocking for them and probably very devastating.
If you could put us in their shoes and explain why they would want to hide this and not confront it head on.
I've heard about students who are afraid to tell their parents, so they're borrowing money from friends, from various friends, just to try to make up the difference that was lost. I think beyond the losing face and feeling kind of stupid about what had happened, there's the sense of them being one of the few students in their area that get to go abroad and study at a school in the United States. And that's a big deal for them and most likely a big deal for their families.
How likely do you think it is that they will get their money back?
I think it's pretty slim. And I think the advocates that are trying to help these students want very much to temper their expectations. For Justin, he's looking at her like she's the culprit, she should be punished, whereas the American legal system is looking at this like, a magnitude of crimes have been committed, and you need evidence to substantiate all of that. For this case to be resolved, I think really involves a lot of manpower and a lot of evidence that we may not have. And I just, I'm really not sure how this is going to work out. But I feel terrible for the students because it seems that they have a picture of America being this sort of place of justice and righteousness. And this is probably going to be the second blow in a series of shocking events for them, is to realize that they may not see a resolution as soon as they would like.
That was Tiffany Ran, who reported on the story for Northwest Asian Weekly. We also heard from Justin Su, a Chinese student at UW, who lost over $11,000 in this scam. He doesn't know how he's going to make up the lost money, but hopes to graduate in spring 2017. The investigation into the case is ongoing. This is Sound Effect, and today's theme is Liar, Liar. And whether or not we'd like to admit it, lying is something everyone does to varying degrees.
I think we probably all tell fibs about things to make ourselves feel good, to make ourselves look more important, to affect someone's opinion of us. We all lie.
That's Terry Ball. He owns and operates a polygraph business. His job is to figure out the truth. He does this by giving people lie detector tests, and he's been doing this for about 30 years. And he has this advice.
If you're telling the truth, come take the test. And the test will verify that to the accuracy of about 95 to 100%. If you aren't telling the truth, don't come to the test. Just don't come. You're wasting your time, your money, and you're opening yourself up to get in a lot of trouble.
These exams have been controversial since they were invented almost 100 years ago. Their accuracy has been seriously called into question by the U.S. Supreme Court. Sometimes the results of polygraph exams are allowed to be used as evidence in superior court, depending on the judge and the attorneys involved in the case. Even though there are questions about its accuracy, the polygraph test is a tool used in different professions. Law enforcement agencies screen potential police officers. Companies sometimes have employees suspected of fraud or theft take an exam. And Terry Ball, he understands the doubt that surrounds these tests. He's the first to admit that there are a lot of bad, unscientific results. He says that a lie detector test is not about the equipment. It's only as good as the person asking the questions.
There's a lot of people giving polygraph tests out there that don't know what they're doing and don't know how to do it right. Everybody thinks we're concerned. That's all we do is operate an instrument. We aren't operators. Our primary skill and job is to interrogate people. Did you steal the money? Are you the person who took the money? Do you know where any part of the money is at this time? Did you cause the death of your wife? Did you shoot your wife? So it all depends upon the individual examiner that's given the test.
Terry has seen just about every situation where the truth is murky. He's heard all of the excuses. He can't talk about most of his cases in detail for confidentiality reasons, but there's one that got coverage in the papers about 15 years ago. He says it was a great example of how good police work teamed up with a skilled polygraph examiner got to the truth. It happened in a small town along the coast of Oregon. A man spent some time in a bar.
This man was in the tavern. I had talked to several of the patrons, left the tavern, and was never seen again. Some years later, I think at least a year, maybe 2 years later, his remains washed up on the beach in Sunnyside, Oregon.
The police officer who did the original investigation had collected all of the names of the people who were in the tavern the night the man disappeared.
So they hired me to give polygraph tests to every single one of the bar patrons from that particular night that the transient disappeared. There was no indication other than the fact that they were in the bar that they had anything to do with this man's disappearance and death. There was one gentleman who had come up from Klamath Falls. Now, they all volunteered to come to Long Beach. He and his girlfriend drove all the way up to take this polygraph test. When I finished the test, I realized that he was lying, that he was the guy that had killed this transient. Within probably an hour, hour and a half, this guy had confessed to killing this man.
The suspect was convicted and sentenced to 7 years for murder. I was hoping to take a lie detector test the day I met Terry, but there wasn't enough time. It's really involved. First, there's the pre-interview.
The examiner and the examinee make up the questions to be asked of them during the test. They actually make them out word for word.
This is done to get rid of any offensive language or trigger words that could interfere with the results. Then the person is attached to the machine.
There's one hose that goes across your stomach and one across your chest.
The hollow tubes track your breathing. A blood pressure cuff keeps track of your heart. Two little paddles are clamped to your hand,
which are used to measure galvanic skin response, which is a measurement of the electrical conductivity of your skin.
All of the responses to the questions are tracked and charted. The charts are then scored, and Terry says it's that final number that says whether you've failed or passed, whether you've lied or you're telling the truth. The entire process takes at least 2 hours. Now, Terry, he loves what he does. And for a long time, it wasn't just about asking the questions and reading the results. Over the years, he's collected dozens of old machines. Modern-day polygraph equipment is a small black box connected to a computer. The old ones are the size of large typewriters or a bread box. Some were painted gold. They were all handmade. He sees so much beauty in them compared to the black box.
Well, it's the difference between looking at a Toyota Celica and looking at a 1966 Cadillac DeVille convertible.
Terry tries to leave his work at the office. When his two daughters were kids, he never threatened to give them a lie detector test, as tempting as that might be for most parents. His girls are now in their 30s, and not too long ago over dinner, they started to tell their father about all of the things they got away with when they were younger. Terry put his hand up.
I stopped him and said, I just don't want to know. I don't want to hear all this stuff. It's not important that I know.
He says when he's not on the job, there are times like this when he just doesn't want to know the truth. Welcome back. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. Today, the theme is Liar, Liar. And so far this hour, we've heard a few examples of some incredible mistruths people have told and why. Money, power, murder. But there are lots of occasions when bending the truth is something we want to happen. This is what more than 60,000 people do every summer in the Nevada desert. Yes, we are talking about Burning Man, the iconic week-long festival with art and music and lots of partying. It's an event that attracts the likes of hippies, Hollywood celebrities, and tech billionaires, young and old. Burning Man is sometimes described as one giant utopian lie. Before going to Burning Man, where he's known as Conifer, like the tree, but with a K, 31-year-old Benjamin Contner's life in Seattle looked good on paper, but didn't feel right. It felt like he was lying to himself.
I got a degree in accountancy and a CPA license. Like, that's what I had been told was like the secure, the smart route to go, you know, to create a professional life for myself and my family, you know. But even at that time, I was always concerned about how the, you know, kind of the disappearing conifers of Seattle and that. And I would like look out from the tower and talk to other people about that. And like, no one else was too interested in it. But I thought it was kind of funny that I had this real concern about these beautiful, like, you know, Northwest trees that.
From the corporate office window.
Right.
Benjamin lost the corporate job with the amazing view during the Great Recession. He was in his 20s. He reevaluated what he was doing with his life. He signed up for AmeriCorps, planting trees in the city's green belts. His first day, he showed up in business casual.
I had like slacks and dress shoes and like a button-up colored shirt. I was just like trained to make a good impression on the first day, right?
The corporate work clothes, these were remnants of the lie Benjamin was slowly separating from. It wasn't until he went to his first Burning Man, when he had to create a different character for himself, Conifer with a K, that he really started to figure things out.
I was able to put on a different persona there, and it felt good. You know, you can say pretty much anything you want, and you're supposed to be taken at that word, you know, and believed. In that aspect, it's no more a lie than, like, you know, any kind of acting is. And you could look at Burning Man as this big, you know, week-long play.
The role that everyone is expected to take on is their own inner rock star.
And really, it's a demonstration of charisma and putting yourself out with more confidence. And what's cool about Burning Man 2 is everyone does kind of look like a rock star there. There's something about the dust that gives people like a silvery, goldish, bronze like tone. And it's all up in the air and everything too. So the way that the light reflects and things there, it has a very dreamlike appeal.
You have your Burning Man name. The desert dust makes you look like a celebrity. You just walked out of a tanning salon. You're riding around on your tricked out bike with lights. It's a barter system. No money's needed. People hand out gifts. There's art everywhere. And for those 7 days, Benjamin says everyone's equal. No one's rich. No one's poor. It's a socialist utopia, even though it's not really true.
I think it is a lie that needs to be told, you know.
In what way?
Because I really believe in the power of hope, you know, as someone who's oscillated between, you know, levels of hope and levels of hopelessness. I think that there has to be a spark that you know, keeps us going, because the world is not a utopia. But to get a little taste of what it could be, I saw, you know, utopia there for a week. And so, you know, humans kind of have that energy stored up in them.
Benjamin says the process of adapting back into everyday life, a job, sitting in traffic, not everyone looking so beautiful, is an adjustment that can take weeks, sometimes months.
In a way, like, we have to push ourselves to get back into the real world, you know, and so we have to kind of cut off some of that Burning Man influence, you know.
What do you have to cut off? What are the things that you cut off?
Putting people before our, you know, livelihoods and needs, you know, personal needs. You go out of your way to help the people around you. I think that's the most different thing. You know, you always carry extra things on you that someone else might need, like water, you know, or food. And you're always offering these things to people. We had someone come to our camp once who had somehow her tent had lit on fire or something. I still don't know, right? But she basically came and, you know, she had lost everything she had. So and we didn't even know her, like, but our camp immediately pulled together whatever extra resources we had to kind of help her out for you know, the rest of the week.
Here in Seattle, do you walk around giving things to people and helping people the way you do that week in the desert?
You know, I don't in general, to be honest. Where I do have that experience though here in Seattle is in the underground electronic music scene. And that's where we are truly taking care of each other and looking out for each other.
Benjamin has been able to hold on to some of the truth he discovered about himself in the Nevada desert. He's gone from that suit and tie accounting job to being a DJ and going to graduate school for international studies. He plans to go back to Burning Man next summer. Now, we've all been in situations where we feel forced to lie out of desperation, hoping to avoid something unpleasant or being inconvenienced in some way. Sound Effects executive producer Erin Hennessy fabricated a few ridiculous lies to get her car back from a tow truck company back when she was a broke student at the University of Washington. Tow truck drivers, they're like knights to the rescue when your car breaks down, but when you park your car in places it shouldn't be? Well, they hear lies all the time from desperate owners. Erin Hennessy sat down with 88.5 Simone Alisea to come clean on some of the mistruths she told back in the day.
Well, I consider it the classic experience. I was a senior in college. I was given a big car by my parents. It was a total clunker. It was a gas guzzler, and it was huge.
Oh, God.
Hard to park, hard to fill up, to keep gas in it, basically, yeah.
And so then what happened? What did you do with it?
Well, you know, I would park it in places where it didn't fit, so I'd block driveways, and I'd just abandon it because I'd run out of gas. And I came up with excuses every time it got towed, and I had to go up to the impound lot on Aurora.
How many times did you get towed?
Three.
It's a lot for a college student.
Yeah, in one academic year. Wasn't spread out over many years. This was about 9 months.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah.
So what was your experience like having to go there and get your car?
Totally scary and agonizing. So I would take this bus from the U District up Aurora. Usually it would be nighttime and it would be straight out of a freaky movie. It would be like kind of greasy, steamy window and neon lights blinking. And I'd go inside and there was a Rottweiler dog on a short chain, just like leaping and foaming and
that's terrifying.
And me going, oh my gosh. And then looking up because they had a desk that was elevated. So the guy, Bobby No Neck, we called him because he was just like bald and no neck and huge and had like a wife beater t-shirt and he had knuckle dusters. I kid you not, knuckle dusters. Oh. And he's the one that would take the money and release the car. Led me to lying. It just didn't feel right that I just come in there and be all polite and give him money. It felt like the enemy.
So you decided to make something up instead?
Absolutely.
And what did you say?
Well, I had many excuses, right? But one that I specifically remember was I parked in a loading zone that said it's okay to park there on Sunday and holidays.
Okay.
And I was parked there in the middle of the week. But I realized as I was taking the bus up on Aurora that it was Canadian Thanksgiving. And so I came in there and I thought, oh, I can get at least a reduction here. And I said, hey, it is a holiday. It's Canadian Thanksgiving and we're so close to the border. And I have so many Canadian cousins. Don't we all have Canadian cousins? Don't we all share that holiday in the spirit?
Oh, you know, your Canadian cousins.
Eh?
And what did he say?
Nothing. Just stone faced. Dog kept barking. It was just like the lie just petered out like nothing.
So the moral of the story is you do not have fond memories of Bobby No Neck.
Absolutely not. No, I have a stereotype of mean, scary tow truck drivers and impound lot dudes.
But you know, you're probably not all that different from a lot of people who get their cars towed. Probably everyone is coming out with something, some excuse, some lie, something to say.
Probably. I didn't think about it at the time.
Well, I want to take this moment to introduce you to somebody. His name is Mohammed Abdu. He's been in the towing business for almost 20 years. He owns All Day Towing in Bellevue and Everett, and his drivers call him Mo, which he has on the back of all of his trucks. His approach to towing is a little different than I think what you're used to.
No. I'm always going to be genuine and sympathetic to people. You cannot run your business like you're holding a grudge against other people. You can't do that. I want to put myself in their position and give them the benefit of the doubt. Okay, maybe it is a mistake, but yeah, no, you can't. You have to always be sympathetic to people.
Well, I'm not completely convinced of that, but
you don't buy it, really, that he...
Not based on what I went through.
If 20-year-old Erin got towed by Muhammad, that he wouldn't actually do that.
That's my guess.
Well, but here's the other thing, too, is these guys hear lies all the time.
My car was stolen, or I was only in the restaurant for 5 minutes. I don't have any money to pay for it. My dad is going to be angry on me, and I really have to get to work. I can't do this. But then 2 seconds later, they pull out a wad of cash.
Well, I think I said probably 90% of that stuff when I went up there.
Right. So then can you really blame him if he's hearing it all the time. Not. They're coming out with the cash.
I guess not, but it just feels like you need to lie anyway.
Did you actually think they'd reduce those fees or anything?
I was playing my role. That's really what it was. I saw Bobby Nonek. He played his role. I played my role. And I was hoping that someday he might, you know, take sympathy and knock off $20.
Here's what I don't understand. They're always able to tell. Muhammad said that he always knows when someone's lying.
You could tell by the looks on their face or how they're talking to you, how they're just looking all over the place and they're just jumping, you know, from one story to another. It'll be easy for you to tell that they're lying.
So wouldn't it have just been easier to do what you were supposed to do?
Well, look at, I would think some of these lies would be entertaining for them. I mean, I would think they might be disappointed if people didn't lie. It's like, I didn't get the performance I was expecting here.
You know, there was this story that Muhammad told me that really stuck with me. And I had asked him about a time he bought into a lie. And he tells me this story about a woman parked in a fire lane. And, you know, as he's putting the car onto the truck, she comes down and has twin babies.
You know, she was crying, she was tearing. And when she came down, the management was outside. And I told him, I said, listen, I know that she's, and this is just something that she was dealing with. Single mom, is it okay if I just go ahead and release the car? I'm not going to charge her anything. I don't need nothing.
And so he gives her the car, and he had already told me he could tell when something was a lie. So I asked, you know, was this really a lie then?
No, it was not a lie. It was actually truth. And the following day, she has sent me brownies. She brought them over to the office and just saying thank you. And I, you know, I understood what she was going through.
So, you know, I went in there and I asked him all kinds of questions about lies, but he came out with this really nice story about truth.
Well, a truth, maybe. She's going through a tough time, but she was still parked illegally. So I actually celebrate that gray area. And I think that we all have our own stories to tell, and you can call them lies or truths or what have you. But at the end of the day, if people can kind of break down the barriers and talk to each other and acknowledge each other's humanities, then lying be damned.
So I'm curious, after all of this, has your opinion about tow truck drivers changed?
Yeah, it has. And that's a good thing.
Okay. If your car was towed today and you had to go to the impound lot, would you tell a story or would you tell the truth?
Well, I love stories, but today absolutely would tell the truth because I just don't want the drama.
That was Sound Effects executive producer Aaron Hennessy and 88.5 Simone Alisea.
That's it for the show this week. Sound Effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad and Ali Ferguson. Contributions this week come from Simone Alisea. We get web help from Dave Nagaris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Be sure to tune in next week when our theme is The Old Me.
I wasn't going to go to school and go, you know, diagramming sentences now just is so much better since I've been crawling than it was before.
I'm Jennifer Wing, and this is 88.5 KNKX.